Epilogue. But still, what happened in Moscow after Volant and his entourage vanished from the capital, departing from Sparrow Hills at sunset on Saturday? It goes without saying that for the longest time, a dense hum of rumours filled the city and quickly spread to the most distant and remote locations in the country. Recounting them all could easily make one sick. Heading by train to Feodosia, the writer of these most truthful words personally heard a story about how 2,000 spectators left a Moscow theatre literally naked and went home in taxicabs in that state. Whispers of evil spirits could be heard in queues standing by the dairy stores, in trams, in stores, in apartments and kitchens, in trains both commuter and long distance, stations big and small, at cottages and on the beaches. Naturally, the more intelligent and cultured folk did not take any part in the gossiping about evil spirits that had visited the city. They would even laugh and try to talk some sense into the storytellers. But facts are facts, as they say, and cannot be brushed aside without proper explanations. Someone had been to the capital. Many things, and especially the smoking pile of cinders that used to be Griboyedov, made this all too clear. Educated people sided with the official investigation. This had been the handiwork of a gang of hypnotists and ventriloquists, extremely skilled in their art. Urgent and drastic measures were taken to bring them to justice, of course, both in Moscow and far beyond, but unfortunately produced no results. The one calling himself Volant disappeared along with all of his associates and never surfaced in Moscow again, or anywhere else for that matter. Quite naturally, there were theories that he had fled abroad, but he failed to turn up there either. The investigation dragged on for a long time. After all, the entire affair was monstrous. In addition to 4 burnt-out buildings and hundreds of psychiatric cases, there were also deaths. 2 could be named with certainty: Berlioz and the unfortunate former Baron Meigel, employee of the bureau responsible for acquainting foreigners with Moscow's sights. Both had been murdered after all. The charred bones of the latter were discovered in apartment number 50 on Sadovaya after the fire was put out. Yes, there were victims, and the victims demanded a thorough investigation. But there were other victims as well, long after Volant had left the capital. These victims were, quite sadly, black cats. At least 100 of these gentle creatures, useful and devoted to man, were shot or otherwise exterminated in various places across the country. Some 2 dozen cats, sometimes badly injured, were delivered to police stations in various cities. For example, in Armavir, one such innocent cat was brought to the police by some gentleman who had tied up the cat's front paws. The gentleman had ambushed the animal, just as the cat, with a sneaky look. Can cats help it if they look like that? It's not because they're guilty of something, but rather because they are afraid that some stronger creature, a man or a dog, may hurt or upset them. Both are easy to do, but nothing to be proud of, let me assure you. Nothing at all. So then, the cat, with a sneaky look, was about to make off into some bushes. Pinning down the cat and tearing off his necktie to bind him, the gentleman threatened venomously. "Aha! So you've decided to show up in Armavir, Mr. Hypnotizer? Well, we're not afraid of you here. Don't pretend to be dumb. We know exactly what kind of bird you are." The gentleman led the cat to the police, dragging the poor animal along by his front paws, bound by the green necktie, and kicking him lightly from behind to make him walk on hind legs. "Stop fooling around, you!" the gentleman shouted to the hooting of neighbourhood kids. "That's not gonna work. You better start walking properly like decent people do." The black cat could only roll his tortured eyes. Deprived by nature of the gift of speech, he had no way to explain himself. The poor animal owed his salvation primarily to the police, and also to his owner, a respectable old widow. As soon as the cat was brought to the police station, it was determined that the gentleman reeked strongly of alcohol, which cast immediate doubt on his testimony. Meanwhile, the little old lady found out from the neighbours that her kitty was in a cell and barely made it to the police station in time. She gave the cat a star reference, saying that she had known him for 5 years, since he was a kitten, and vouched for him as she would for her own self. She also proved that the cat had not been charged with any mischievous activity and that he had never been to Moscow. The cat was born in Armavir. There he was raised and there he learned to catch mice. The cat was untied and returned to his owner, having tasted the woeful consequences of error and slander. In addition to the cats, several people suffered minor inconveniences. Several arrests were made. Among the briefly detained, in Leningrad, a Mr. Volman and a Mr. Volper, in Saratov, Kiev and Kharkov, 3 Volodins, in Kazan, a Mr. Voloch, and in Penza, for reasons which remain a mystery to this day, a Mr. Vachinkievich, Doctor of Chemical Sciences. It is true, however, that he was immensely tall, dark-skinned and dark-haired. Additionally, 9 Korovins, 4 Korovkins and 2 Karvaevs were apprehended in various locations. A certain man was tied up and removed from the Sevastopol train at Belgorod station. He had decided to entertain the other passengers with some card tricks. Another man appeared in a Yaroslav restaurant around dinner time, carrying a primus he had just had repaired. Upon seeing him, both attendants abandoned their posts in the coat room and fled the restaurant, followed by all the customers and the staff. In the course of all this, the day's earnings somehow went missing from the cash register. Many other things happened, too many to remember. There was great intellectual ferment. Proper credit is due, over and over, to the investigation. Everything humanly possible was done, both to apprehend the criminals and explain all that they had done. And explain it they did, and everyone had to admit that the explanations were sensible and indisputable. Consulting with expert psychiatrists, the detectives established that the gang members, or at least one of them, suspicion fell primarily on Korovyov, had mastered extraordinary hypnotic powers, giving them the ability to manifest false, displaced images of themselves while actually being located elsewhere. Moreover, they could easily suggest to anyone they came across that certain people and things were present where they were not, or, conversely, make people unable to see objects and people that were actually there. In light of these explanations, absolutely everything became clear, and even the worrisome incident involving the inexplicably invincible cat in apartment number 50, who came under fire during attempts to arrest him. Naturally, there were absolutely no cats on the chandelier, and no one was shooting back at the men, who were themselves shooting at empty space. Having convinced everyone that a cat was making trouble on the chandelier, Korovyov was free to snigger behind the detectives' backs, delighting in his enormous, albeit criminally misused, powers of suggestion. He was also the one who set the apartment on fire using petrol. Of course, Stiopa Likhodayev never went to Yalta. Even Korovyov could not pull something like that off, and did not send any telegrams. After he had fainted in the jeweller's wife's apartment, frightened by Korovyov's illusion of an enormous cat eating pickled mushrooms with a fork, Stiopa simply lay there until Korovyov mockingly slapped a sheepskin hat on him and sent him to Moscow's airport, having previously impressed upon the detectives that Stiopa would be coming from Sevastopol via airplane. True, Yalta's criminal investigation department insisted that it had taken in a barefoot Stiopa and sent the appropriate telegrams to Moscow. However, not a single copy of the telegrams could be found, leading the detectives to the distressing but utterly inescapable conclusion that the criminal gang was able to hypnotise people over enormous distances and affect not only individuals but entire groups. Under such circumstances, the criminals were able to drive even the most psychologically stable individuals out of their minds. What are trifles, like planting a deck of cards in the audience, or making ladies' dresses disappear, or a meowing beret, or anything else of that sort? Any professional hypnotist of average ability could pull something like that off on any stage, including the primitive illusion of tearing the MC's head off. The talking cat was also utter nonsense. Anyone with a basic command of ventriloquism could produce such a cat, and few doubted that Korovyov's artistry went far beyond the basics. Yes, The problem here was not a deck of cards or a fake letter in Nikanor Ivanovich's briefcase. That was child's play. It was he, Korovyov, who led Berlioz to certain death under a tram. It was he who drove the poor poet Ivan homeless out of his mind and tormented him with visions of ancient Yerushalayim and the sun-baked, waterless, bald mountain with three men hanging on posts. It was he and his gang who were responsible for the disappearance of Margarita Nikolaevna and her housekeeper Natasha from Moscow. Incidentally, this last case received special attention. It was necessary to determine whether the women had been kidnapped by the gang of murderers and arsonists, or whether they had accompanied the criminal group of their own free will. The investigation relied on Nikolai Ivanovich's inept and confusing testimony, and took into account the strange and nonsensical note left by Margarita Nikolaevna for her husband, stating that she was leaving him to be a witch. Finally, considering the fact that Natasha had vanished without a single article of wearable clothing, the investigators came to the conclusion that both mistress and maid had been hypnotized and kidnapped by the gang, like so many others. The detectives put forth a sensible and probably correct hypothesis that the criminals were enticed by the beauty of both women. However, the investigation could not find any motive for the kidnapping of a mental patient who called himself the Master from a psychiatric clinic. Neither could the patient's name be found. Thus, he disappeared forever, known only by the dead name of number 118 from Block 1. And so, almost everything had been explained, and, like all things, the investigation ended. Several years passed, and people began to forget all about Volant, Korovyov, and the others. Many changes took place in the lives of those who suffered from Volant and his associates. We would do well to mention them, no matter how small or insignificant. George Bengalski, for instance, spent 4 months in the clinic and got better. He was forced to abandon his position at the Variety, however, at a time when memories of the seance of black magic were fresh and tickets sold extremely well. Bengalski had to quit the Variety because he realised that he could not bear standing in front of 2,000 people every night, who would inevitably recognise him and badger him with mocking questions as to how he liked it better, with a head or without. Besides, the MC also lost the greater part of his former cheer, so necessary in his profession. He could not get rid of his painful habit of falling into a state of anxiety during every full moon in spring, when he would suddenly start looking around fearfully, grasping his neck and crying. The fits passed, but it was impossible to work under such conditions. The MC retired and began to live on his savings, estimating modestly that they would last him about 15 years. He left, never again to meet Varyonika, who garnered universal popularity and affection for his astonishing sensitivity and politeness, making him stand out among all theatre managers. The free ticket hounds would call him no less than their father and benefactor. No matter who called the Variety or when, his sad and gentle voice would always respond, "I am listening." Whenever someone wanted to speak to Varyonika, the same voice would reply hastily, "I am at your service." But on the other hand, Ivan Savelyevich's politeness would often be abused. As for Stiopa Likhodayev, he would never answer the Variety's phone again. Immediately after his release from the clinic, where Stiopa spent 8 days, he was transferred to Rostov and appointed manager of a large grocery store. Rumour has it that he has completely forsaken port wine in favour of blackcurrant vodka, thus greatly improving his health. They say he is quiet and avoids women. Stefan Bogdanovich's removal from the Variety did not bring Rimsky the relief he had so passionately desired for several years. Following his release from the clinic and a vacation in Kislovodsk, the shaking, ever-so-old man who used to be the finance director submitted his resignation from the position at the Variety. Interestingly, the resignation was delivered to the theatre by his wife. Grigory Danilovich could not bring himself to return, even in the daytime, to the building where he had seen the cracked, moonlit window, with the long arm stretching towards the lower latch. Dismissed from the Variety, the finance director worked at a puppet theatre in Zamoskvoretia. However, he no longer had to consult with the venerable Arkady Apollonovich Sempelyarov regarding matters of acoustics. The latter was transferred speedily to Bryansk and placed in charge of a mushroom cannery. Today, Muscovites eat his salted and pickled mushrooms and cannot praise them enough. Everyone is immensely pleased with the transfer. When all was said and done, Arkady Apollonovich had far more success there than he did in the field of acoustics. No matter how much he tried to improve them, the acoustics stayed pretty much the same. Other people who abandoned theatre included Nikonor Ivanovich Bosoy, although his involvement with the arts was limited to his love of free tickets. Nikonor Ivanovich never visits a theatre any more, be it paid or free, and his expression changes whenever a conversation turns to theatre. Besides theatre, he has acquired an even greater hatred for the poet Pushkin and for the talented actor known as Sava Potapovich Kurolyesov. So strong is his hatred that last year, upon discovering a black-framed notice in the paper informing of Sava Potapovich's death from a heart attack at the peak of his career, Nikonor Ivanovich turned purple and roared, "Serves him right!" in a voice so terrible that he nearly followed Sava Potapovich. The popular actor's death evoked many troubling memories. That night, with only the moon over Sadovaya for company, Nikonor Ivanovich got terribly drunk, and with every glass, another person joined the hateful chain of memories, Sergei Gerardovich Dunchil, and the beautiful Ida Herculanovna, and the red-haired owner of the Fighting Geese, and the Frank Nikolai Konavkin. But what happened to them? Please, absolutely nothing happened, nor could it ever, for none of them really existed. Neither did the likeable MC actor, or the theatre itself, or the stingy aunt hoarding rotten foreign currency in her cellar, and certainly not the golden trumpets or the insolent cooks. Nikonor Ivanovich had imagined it all, influenced by that scum Korofiov. The only real person in his dream had been the actor, Sava Potapovich, and only because Nikonor Ivanovich remembered him from his frequent appearances on the radio. He existed, but the others did not. So perhaps Aloysius Mogarich did not exist either. Oh, no, he existed all right, and still does, occupying the very position that Rimsky refused, financial director at the Variety. After coming to his senses on a train somewhere near Viatka, about a day after leaving Volant's apartment, Aloysius discovered that in a clouded state of mind, he had somehow managed to leave Moscow. Not only that, but he had apparently stolen his landlord's ledger for some reason and forgotten to put on trousers. Paying the conductor an immense sum, Aloysius obtained an old, dirty pair of trousers from him and returned from Viatka. But alas, the landlord's house was gone. The flimsy structure had been completely demolished by fire. Aloysius was a very enterprising fellow, however, and 2 weeks later he was already living in an excellent room on Brusovsky Lane. Several months later he was sitting in Rimsky's office, and just as Rimsky once suffered on account of Stiopa, so does Varionika now suffer on account of Aloysius. Ivan Savelyevich can only dream that Aloysius be removed from the Variety and vanish from his sight. As he sometimes says in trusted company, never in his life has he met scum like this Aloysius, and one could expect absolutely anything from the likes of him. But perhaps the manager is unduly biased. During his tenure at the Variety, Aloysius has not been known to participate in any shady business, or any business for that matter. His only action so far has been to appoint a new bartender instead of Sokov. Andrei Fokich died of cancer of the liver at the first MSU clinic 9 months after Volant appeared in Moscow. Yes, several years passed, and the events so truthfully depicted in this book grew hazy and faded from memory. But not for everyone. Not for everyone. Every year, on the festive springtime full moon, a man about 30 years of age appears under the lindens at Patriarch's Ponds. Redhead, green-eyed, modestly dressed, he is an associate at the Institute of History and Philosophy, Professor Ivan Nikolaevich Punirov. He walks under the lindens and inevitably sits on the same bench where he sat on the evening when the long-forgotten Berlioz saw the moon shatter in the sky for the last time in his life. The moon is whole now. It starts off white and turns golden as the evening goes on, floating over the former poet Ivan Nikolaevich, and yet standing in place, the silhouette of a dark horse, or perhaps a dragon on its surface. Ivan Nikolaevich knows and understands everything. He is aware that, as a young man, he had fallen victim to criminal hypnotists. He knows that he was treated and got better, but he also knows that there are things he cannot control. He cannot overcome the springtime full moon. As soon as it approaches, as soon as the waxing luminary appears in the sky and swells with gold, just as it once did above the 2 5-branched candelabra in an ancient city, Ivan Nikolaevich becomes anxious and troubled. He loses sleep and appetite, waiting for the moon to ripen. And when the full moon comes, nothing can keep Ivan Nikolaevich at home. When evening comes, he leaves for Patriarch's Ponds. Sitting on the bench, Ivan Nikolaevich talks openly to himself, smokes a cigarette, and squints at the moon or at the all-too-familiar turnstile. He spends an hour or two in this fashion. Then he gets up, his eyes empty and unseeing. He always takes the exact same route through Spiridonovka, through the Arbat alleys. He passes a paraffin shop and reaches a corner with an old rickety gas streetlight. Turning, he sneaks towards a fence surrounding a lush but still barren garden. Inside stands an old Gothic mansion. Moonlight washes over the side of the building with a large bay window, and the other side is dark. The professor does not know what draws him to the fence or who lives in the mansion, but he knows also that he cannot fight his urge when the moon is full. Furthermore, he knows that he will invariably see the same thing through the fence. He will see a respectable, elderly, bearded gentleman in a pince-nez, with ever so slightly porcine facial features, sitting on a bench. Ivan Nikolaevich always finds the mansion resident in the same position, gazing wistfully at the moon. Ivan Nikolaevich knows that after admiring the moon, the sitting man will inevitably look over to the bay window as if expecting it to fling open and reveal something amazing. Ivan Nikolaevich knows the rest by heart. He hides carefully by the fence, for the sitting man will now begin to look around anxiously, searching for something in the air with wandering eyes. The man will smile rapturously, then clasp his hands together in sweet sorrow, and mutter openly and quite loudly, "Venus, Venus, oh, what a fool I am! Oh, gods, ye gods," Ivan Nikolaevich will whisper, hiding behind the fence, without taking his burning eyes off the mysterious stranger. "Another victim of the moon, like me." And the sitting man will continue, "Oh, what a fool I am. Why? Why didn't I fly away with her? What were you afraid of, you old ass? Got yourself a document, did you? Now stay and suffer, old cretin." This will continue until a window slams open in a dark part of the mansion. A white shape will appear, and an unpleasant female voice will say,
"Nikolai Ivanovich, where are you? What are you fantasizing about out there? Do you want to catch malaria? Come inside for tea."
The sitting man will come to, of course, and reply in a false voice, "Just wanted to breathe the air, my darling. The air's really fresh." He will rise from the bench, shake his fist furtively at the closing window, and trudge back into the house.
"Lies, lies. Oh, gods, how he lies,"
Ivan Nikolaevich mutters, walking away from the fence.
"It's not the air at all that draws him out into the garden. He can see something up there in the spring moonlight, somewhere high above. Oh, the things I would give to learn his secret, to know the Venus he lost and now seeks in vain, searching for her in the air."
The professor returns home completely ill. His wife pretends not to notice his condition and hurries him to bed. But she does not go to bed herself. Instead, she sits by the lamp holding a book and gazes bitterly at the sleeping man. She knows that at dawn, Ivan Nikolaevich will wake up screaming painfully, crying and convulsing. And therefore, a syringe lies before her on the table, next to a bottle of dark, tea-coloured liquid. After the shot, the poor woman, who has tied her life to a seriously ill man, is free to go to bed without fear. Ivan Nikolaevich will now sleep peacefully until dawn and see unknown but joyous and inspiring dreams. The same thing always drives the scholar to pitiful screams on the night of the full moon. He sees an unnatural, noseless executioner jumping up with a hoot and stabbing an insane, bound Hestas in the heart with a spear. It is not so much the executioner that frightens him so, but the eerie light from a boiling storm cloud above that rolls over the earth, as it only happens in times of world catastrophe. After the shot, everything changes in the dream. A broad path made of moonlight stretches from the bed to the window. A man in a white cape with blood-red lining steps onto the path and walks towards the moon. A disfigured young man in a torn chiton walks beside him. They talk heatedly and argue amongst themselves, trying to arrive at some conclusion.
"Oh, gods, ye gods," says the man in the cape, turning his haughty face to his companion. "What an obscene execution! But please, tell me,"
and the haughtiness turns to pleading,
"that it never happened. I beg you, tell me it never happened."
"Of course it didn't,"
the young man says in a hoarse voice.
"You imagined it."
"And can you swear to it?"
the man in the cape grovels.
"I swear,"
his companion says, a smile beaming from his eyes for some reason.
"Then that is all I need," the man in the cape cries out in a torn voice and continues ascending towards the moon, drawing along his companion.
An enormous, sharp-eared dog walks calmly and majestically behind them. The moonlit path boils over into a flowing river of moonlight that spills in all directions. The moon conquers and plays. The moon dances and frolics. A woman of immeasurable beauty appears in the stream, leading a stubbly man who is gazing round fearfully. Ivan Nikolaevich recognizes him at once. It is number 118, his nighttime guest. Ivan Nikolaevich stretches out his arms greedily in his sleep and asks,
"So that's how it ends."
"That's how it ends, my disciple," number 118 replies. And then the woman approaches Ivan and says,
"Of course, it's ended, and everything ends. Let me give you a kiss on the forehead, and all will be well."
She leans down to Ivan and kisses him on the forehead. Ivan reaches out to her and looks into her eyes. But she retreats and walks away towards the moon with her companion. The moon begins to rage, raining torrents of light on Ivan, splashing it in all directions. The room is flooded with moonlight. Swaying, it rises and engulfs the bed. And it is then that Ivan Nikolaevich sleeps peacefully with a blissful expression on his face. The next morning he wakes up silent, but completely calm and well. His tortured memory fades, and until the next full moon, no one will disturb the professor. Neither Hestus's noseless killer, nor the cruel fifth procurator of Judea, the knight Pontius Pilate.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.